question, I would like to thank the committee for asking me to do this. And my name is Christy, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Christy! Lots and lots and lots! And more lunches!
Why, thank you. But you forgot bagels and logs. Yes. I always hate the very beginning because you stop and go, where do I begin? So I'll begin at the very beginning. I was born in Houston, Texas, which is a wonderful place. And January 6, 1969, what a great year. Woodstock, they walked on the moon, and I was born. If you look at the outside of my family, you wouldn't see anything wrong with it. Everything was picture perfect. But on the inside, that's another story. I like to say it was like World War III. I have a younger brother, and the very first thing that I can remember is being fearful. And because it was very crazy and chaotic within my family. My father was very abusive, and my mother, being the lovely untreated Al-Anon that she is, allowed it to continue for quite a while. I never felt quite right. Something was always off. I can't tell you when I took my first drink. Alcohol was always around my family. My dad would, on Saturdays, be watching TV, and there'd be beer and have sips of beers. I've even seen pictures of me around 4 or 5 years old drinking. So I can't exactly tell you when. Alcohol has always been present in my life. And my parents divorced when I was 6. And I wasn't one of those kids that was really upset that their parents got divorced. I was actually really happy because I thought that if my dad had left, then things would get better. But the reality of the situation is that it didn't. My very first drunk, and this is important because I was about 8 years old, and we were at my grandfather's birthday party, and they always thought it was really cute for the kids to have a glass of wine with the adults. And I remember taking that wine and drinking it. And then I remember that I wanted more. And I went around the table and kind of sat with everyone and sat there and drank some more. And by the end of the night, I was totally sloshed. What I remember of that is that warm feeling that that made everything seem like it was okay. And everything, it took the edges off. And I wanted more. It was like the first time that I felt like things would be all right. I wasn't one of those that drank because of peer pressure. I drank so I didn't have to deal with the reality of what was going on in my life. The only emotion that was allowed really to be expressed in my house was anger. And so everybody went around yelling at everybody. So, and I used it as a way to escape, and so I didn't have to feel those feelings of knowing that this isn't the way that it's supposed to be. I mean, I got that really early on, that my life was not supposed to be like this. And alcohol was the only thing that seemed to make things okay. My mother remarried, and of course she married a drunk. So by this time, I would say around age 11 or 12, what I was doing is that my parents would go to sleep, and there was always booze in the house, and I would sneak downstairs, and I would drink a couple swigs out of wine out of the bottle, and I would put it back, and that was like my night tonic, you know, kind of take the edge off, go to sleep, everything's wonderful. And that's how it, and then it soon progressed even more for me. And it was absolutely nuts in the house, because by this time, my stepfather's a drunk, I'm drinking, my brother's drinking, and then we've got the wild, crazy mother going on. So you never knew exactly what was going to happen. And the kind of drunk that my stepfather was, he was, you didn't know exactly when he came home how he was going to be. So we all kind of walked around on eggshells going, okay, what's it going to be like today? And sometimes he'd come home and he'd be in a good mood because, of course, he'd have his six-pack on the way home from work. And, you know, the quick little nips here and there. And so it was just waiting for the explosion to happen. My real dad at this time took off. Like to say he works for concrete. he went into hiding. And I didn't hear from him until I actually got sober. And what's sad about that is that it took me being in a hospital and supposedly a drunk for him to call and take notice. And so he never really was a part of my life. And so I like to say that my stepfather had the biggest impact on me. So basically, growing up in an alcoholic household. And it was really interesting because by this time, my drinking had really started to take off. I started drinking at school. And some of those of you that remember those old Final Net hairspray bottles, this was, we'd pour the hairspray out and put vodka in them. And so I started taking them to school. And I started drinking at campus. And that was pretty much my experience. You know, after school, we'd get drunk. And parties, anything, so I didn't have to be at home. And what was sad is I didn't want to be like my stepfather, and I didn't want to be that kind of drunk, but the more my alcoholism progressed, I ended up being more and more like him. And so it's almost like a double-edged sword. And to kind of sum it up, there's one story in particular that really kind of says it all. I was about a sophomore in high school, and it was the senior's last day, but anything for a party. And we started drinking at lunch. And after school was over, of course, there was the pre-party before the pre-party and the party. And so I wasn't driving. I was with my my girlfriend, Amy, and proceeded to get extremely sloshed. And so there's this big, huge party at a friend's house, and by this time, I'm pretty far gone. And I was spending the night at Amy's house because my parents allowed us to drink, and they even bought my booze. And so it was pretty accepted, but I didn't want to stay at home. So I always had friends that I spent the night at to try to get away from what was going on in my house. And so we get to the big party, and of course, I want to be the center of attention. So I'm sitting there flitting around. Hi, how you doing? How are things going? Yeah. And I proceed to sit down on the glass top table, and the thing tips over, and all the beer cans roll off into the middle of the floor. And, of course, I'm the center of attention. I was getting really sick at this point. So I proceeded to go off and throw up on my leg like I usually do. And by this time, I know that I have to go find my friend because one of the things I was really terrified about was being left drunk. And I tended to get left drunk quite a bit. And so I went to go look for her, and I found her. And at this point, I'm so inebriated that I'm basically holding on to the back of her belt loops and being led around the party. We decided that it's time to go home, and I'm basically cannot barely walk at this time. We get in her boyfriend's truck. Of course, we have to pull over a couple of times so I can throw up. We make it to her parents' house, and I can barely make it in the front door. Of where I'm basically on my hands and knees at this point, crawling up the stairs. Little did I know that her father was standing at the bottom of the staircase. So I make it up into the bedroom and basically fall out in her bed. And the room is spinning, and my stomach's spinning, and I have to go pee. And it's the middle of the night. And I get up, and of course, I miss the bathroom, and I pee in her closet. I make it back to the bed, thankfully, and I wake up that morning to her throwing a towel at me, saying, "You need to go take a shower and you need to clean up the closet." And then after I cleaned up the closet and took a shower, I got dressed and I came out, and she said, "My dad said that you can't spend the night here ever again." You know, the story's really funny, but the ending, I mean, this is how my life always seemed to end up. "I'm sorry, but you can't spend the night here ever again, and I'm not allowed to hang out with you anymore." And this is how my drinking throughout my whole career, you know, I would start out with really great friends, and once you got the booze in me, there was no telling what I was going to end up like. I could be happy, I could be, you know, dancing on top of tables, I could be falling down drunk, and them having to carry me home, and I always ended up pissing these people off and losing all my friends. I went to my mother when I was 16 years old, and I told her I thought I was an alcoholic. Because by this time, the drinking had really gotten out of control. And I'd started experimenting with other things also. And so I told my mom, and it took everything I had in me to, like, go to her and tell her that I was an alcoholic. Because, like I said, the outside trappings looked really good, and you had the two cars and the swimming pool. You know, Daddy is the vice president of one of the top engineering firms in Houston. But do not tell anyone what's going on inside this house. And knowing that, I don't know where the strength came from to go to her and tell her this. And she just looked at me and started crying, and she's like, "Well, I have to talk to your stepfather." So a couple of days go by, and she comes to me and says, "Well, we really don't think that you have a problem. Larry thinks that you're just trying to get attention." And that was all that was said. And the whole matter was dropped. I storm out of there and proceed to go on a jag. And I come home about a day, 2 days later. And where have you been? "Friends, you know, you need to stay home. I don't want you out." "Fine. Okay, I have some a list of chores for you to do. And we'll talk about this later." So I decided at that point that I had pretty much had enough. So I go in the medicine cabinet and I proceed to take a bunch of pills. But then I remembered that I had the list of chores that I had to do. So I'm with the vacuum cleaner and I had taken a bunch of pain pills, and I'm sitting there vacuuming because I'm in total fear of what the repercussions would be when my mom got home. And when she found me, I was kind of like half hanging on the vacuum cleaner and pushing it. And she goes, "What have you done?" And because she'd walked into the kitchen and came back, and she'd noticed that the pills, because I conveniently had left a few there. And she says, "What have you done?" And I didn't say anything to her. And the next thing I know, she's grabbing me by the arm, throwing me in the car. And we go to Ecker Drugs. And she walks in Ecker Drugs, and she comes back out. Do you know what that stuff syrup by Vicapack is? It's what they give little kids when they've, like, taken too many vitamins or something. It makes you throw up. So we get home, and she basically forces the syrup of Vicapack down my throat. And I throw up. And That was all that was ever said. Complete end of the story. She never said anything else to me again. And it's just that series of denial with the raging husband that's an alcoholic and the two kids that are alcoholics. And it's such a family disease. It really is. So after that, my drinking took off with a vengeance and proceeded with other things also. And it just got worse and worse and worse. I felt like when I was born, I had that huge hole, that gaping hole, that nothing. You know, alcohol worked at first to fill that hole. And then you know, whatever else was available would fill that hole. And then it just quit working. It totally quit working. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And I was at a... I made a pact with myself when I went off to college. I don't know how I got through high school, but I did. I made a pact with myself when I went to college that I was going to not drink. And I would go through periods of this. I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to use. I'm going to drink, but I'm not going to use. I'm going to drink, and I'm just going to smoke pot. So it was like a series of progressions. So I decided that I was going to start fresh. I was going to start new. I was going to go to college. My life was going to be good. No one knew me there. I was going to start over. And I got there, and the third day I was drunk. But I stuck to my guns, and I said, okay, I'm drinking. Fine. I'm going to do this thing. And I actually did pretty well. I was nominated for president of my freshman class, and I had a 3.8 the first semester, and was a little sister to a fraternity, and that was the big mistake. Being a little sister to this fraternity, it was like party all the time, and I started using, and that, I believe, is what got me here as quickly as it did. I am an alcoholic. Everything else is but a symptom of my disease. I started out with booze. My last was booze. And whatever else was in between was in the series of trying to fill that hole. And during this time, my brother ends up in treatment. The school called and had intervened on him. And of course, he proceeds to tell her everything that I'm doing. It was okay if we drank, that was fine. But the other stuff, she didn't like that too much. And I hid that as best as possible from them. And I was told that I had to come home. So I come home. And the heat is on. They're watching me like a hawk 24/7. And at this time, my alcoholism and drug abuse have progressed to the point to where when I came home, I didn't have any connections, so I was only drinking. And I started detoxing at home. And it was bad. I was up pretty much all night long. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was having flashbacks, having tremors, and the booze wasn't cutting it. And I knew I had to get back to school. I had to get back. I could not take this. And I went back up to school, went on a 3-day jag. I came home, and through a series of progression, I had a drug-induced nervous breakdown. And my mother found me at home after I'd come home, where I'd taken everything in the kitchen and had thrown it in the middle of the floor, and was just basically screaming and out of control. And so she grabs me and says, you're going into treatment. And for some reason, I come to. No, I'm not. I'm fine. I'm not going into treatment. I had a bad day. It's funny how you catch a snap like that. And so she said, okay. All right, fine. But I want to tell you something, and I'll talk to you later about it. So a couple of days later, I get this phone call. My brother's still in treatment at this time. We have this wonderful family therapy session for your brother. Oh, okay, I'll come down to the treatment center. Anything for Joey. Anything for him. And I get there, and it was an intervention. And the therapist is talking to me. You're sick. You're an alcoholic. You need help. You want to go in? No. You're sick. You're an alcoholic. You need help. No. And my brother and I didn't have the greatest relationship in the world. Basically, we just kind of avoided each other. And when we were kids, we were really mean to each other and used to beat each other up. And then when he got bigger, that all changed. So it wasn't the best relationship in the world. And he looked at me and he says, you're killing yourself and you're dying. And I don't want to see that happen. And at that moment, I knew that he was right. And I said, okay. So I went into treatment. But I lied from the time I got in there to the time I got out. Booze had quit working for me. All that stuff, the spending the money, the men, the food, the clothes, the shopping, all of that had quit working for me. And, you know, I was at the point where I wanted to die. And I didn't know exactly what to do. I didn't want to be in treatment, but I knew, God, something's got to be better than this. Something has to be better than this. So I went into treatment, but that denial is so strong. Because when I got in, I lied from the time I got in there until the time I got out. And all I did was wreak havoc. And I was just pissed off at the world. I was so angry. And it's so hard to explain sometimes of like the relationship with my mother and I. It's one of those love-hate relationships. And at this time I thought that, oh God, she's doing it to me again. But it's probably one of the best things that she ever did. Before I got checked out of treatment, she told me that I couldn't come home. And basically I got the hint when she had moved from a three-bedroom house to a two-bedroom house and my stuff was out in the garage. And she said, you can't come home. And all I had was my car and my clothes on my back and some furniture in the garage, and I didn't know what was going to happen. And I believe that God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And there was a girl that had went through treatment there, and she said, went through a halfway house, and she said that there was a free bed available if I was willing to go to halfway. And at that time I didn't have any options, so I said, okay, I'll go to halfway. Better to have a roof over the head than sleeping on the street. And from the time I got into halfway, I was on probation. I could not follow the rules. I wanted to buck the system. I didn't want to follow directions, and if they said go left, I went right. And I did just enough to get by. And that is the story of my first year in sobriety. Oh, by the way, my sobriety date is 4/11/88. And so I'll throw that in there. That is the story of my first year of sobriety. So I get out of halfway and I move in with some friends. And my first year, I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. And wreaked havoc wherever I went. When I would go into an AA meeting, you knew I was there. Look at me, hello. That tornado worrying in people's lives, constantly. And I wanted you to know how pissed off and how angry I was, and look at me, poor me, my life is horrible. If you think about it, it kind of sounds like one of those bad after-school specials. Her father abandoned her. Her mother despised her. Her stepfather was a drunk. She was a teenage alcoholic. Feel sorry for me. Thank God people didn't cut me any slack. Because I was doing all the same things. I mean, here I had all these tools in front of me, and I could sit in meetings and I could see people happy and joyous and free, and they're getting their stuff together and they're working and they're productive and they're happy and they feel whole and they have a God of their understanding. But yet I was unwilling to do that. And at about a year sober, I had six of my girlfriends sit me down, and I basically, by this time, had become the AA young people's pariah. "Christy, we love you, but we don't like you. And we can't be your friends any longer. Something's got to give. Something's got to change." You know, I had lied to them. I had stolen from them. I had used them. Life was better sober that length of time that I had. And I knew that maybe, just maybe, if I did what they suggested, that my life would change. And I didn't want to go back to where I had come from, because I knew that I would be dead. Either I would kill myself, or I would drink myself, or other things. And I knew that maybe I had a chance. So I went out on this wonderful sponsor search, and I looked for one that would kick me in the rear and would not put up with my stuff. And I owe a lot to that woman, because Lord knows she put up with me. And she comes from a very strong line of sponsorship, and I give credit to my sponsors today. For the guidance and the love and the understanding that they have given me. And she was an interesting character. I would call her up, of course, moaning and whining, and she would say, "Okay, when you're ready to do something about it, call me." And she'd hang up on me. And I'd be like, "How dare her hang up on me?" And if I did what she suggested, it usually worked out. And she had some of the best sayings. I just love this one. "Don't drink, go to meetings and wear lipstick." "All you get when you sit on the fence is a sore crotch." She introduced me to service work by putting a garbage bag in my hand and said, "Here, you need to pick up garbage." And I was like, "Me? Pick up garbage?" She said, "Yes. You want to be a part of, and you're willing to do whatever it takes, you need to pick up garbage." And I said, "Okay." So I picked up garbage. Then I progressed to ashtrays. This is when you were still able to smoke in meetings. Clean the ashtrays. Then moved on to coffee. Then she got me involved in young people's service. She was actually one of the founders of the first young people's group in Houston. And so she had an extremely special place in her heart, and so that's where she started me off. And what's great about young people's service is it acts as such a wonderful springboard into the real world. And I have learned so much, not only about myself, but how to get along with others. And I started working on different conferences in the city of Houston and in our state, and then eventually the international conference. And so she got me involved in service, and I started working the steps. And it was amazing. And how my life started to change. Of course, I'm still a little off, but my life started to change enough to where I could see that hope, and I could see that things could get better. And the thing that I credit the most was that when I sat down and did my four-step with her, spoke my fist up with her, was that it was the first person that I ever felt that listened to me. Whenever I would say something to someone, whether it be my family, whether it be friends, whether it be whatever, I never felt like I was heard. I never felt that connection between two people, that when you're sitting there eye to eye and you're sharing something extremely important with them, I never felt like I was heard. And she was the first person that I learned to trust. And from that trust, for me, the program started to flower. I mean, she said, "Do you believe that I believe?" And we're talking about God here. And for me, the whole God thing was such a hard thing because I felt like God had abandoned me, those whole things. So she's like, "Well, do you believe that I believe?" And I believed that she believed. And it started from there. And it worked. And I worked through my steps. I continued with my service work. I had that unity. And there's something about young people when they come into the program. I know for me that I felt like I was 12 feet tall and bulletproof, and that nothing bad, you know, once that good stuff starts rolling in your life and you see some of the promises happening, that nothing bad is ever going to happen to me again. Well, at about 3 years sober, I started getting sick. And this is important for me to tell because it's part of my spiritual journey. It's part of my eye-opening awakening of being here and present with you today. So I'm going to share briefly about it. I got sick. I started getting sick, started throwing up uncontrollably, couldn't stop, went to doctors, ran every single test imaginable, could not find out what was wrong with me. And this happened for like a 3-month period where I was in and out of hospitals, and I probably was out of the hospital maybe 12 days out of the first 2 months. And finally, I was diagnosed with having 3 diseases that are in the lupus family. And by this time, I was so sick that I was dying. And I had to go through extensive chemotherapy and steroid treatments. But I wasn't going to let this thing beat me. I had gotten sober. I had finally started receiving those promises. I needed to go forward, and I didn't want to give up. And I was in the hospital probably at this point for a good month, and they had started giving me this treatment. And it felt like one night when I was notorious for roaming the hospitals at night, and I was sitting out in the courtyard, and I decided to come back inside. And I know this sounds really cheesy, but I'm watching MTV. Thank God they had cable. I'm watching MTV, and there's REM's Losing My Religion playing on the thing. And for some reason, something at that moment just clicked. And everything that I had believed in up until that point changed. My God changed. It's amazing what happens when some kind of life-threatening illness happens. I realized what was finally important and what wasn't important. I realized that it wasn't the outside material things that made me who I was. It wasn't the person that I was with that made me who I was. And it was how I loved people. It was that kindness and that giving and that caring towards another human being that when we talk about in the 12 steps, that's what makes me. The love that I can give another human being. And for me, it opened the doors. It really made me see what I needed to do. I realized what my purpose was. And I knew who I was for the first time ever. And I'm not going to say that everything since then has been wonderful, because it hasn't been. You know, life continues to happen. Things still come to me. The day-to-day stuff seeps in. And I started getting into that routine again of just being bogged down with everyday life. During this time, I had also gotten married and had transferred with my husband to Atlanta. And the first thing that I knew that I needed to do was hook up with service. So, of course, I had been involved with Young People's There, so I sought out Young People's Here. And I got extremely involved with service, and I started, you know, immediately going to meetings because I knew that I could just disappear with a drop of a hat if I wanted to, because nobody cared. So it was very important for me to do that. So I was out there doing service, doing the deal. Life was continuing to happen. Things were going on. Something started to change for me. At about 6.5 years sober, my marriage was going sour. The relationships that I had with people seemed to be really surface. It was very hard to start going into an AA meeting and sitting there and listen to the message, because all I heard was, oh God, he's going to share again, you know? Oh, what's wrong with her? And the whole point of the matter was it had to do with me. Somewhere along the day-to-day grind, the stuff that happens here and the stuff that happens there, I started to lose service to God. So I said my third step prayer, I'd say my seventh step prayer. You know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. But something inside, I needed more. And I needed help. And once again, God does for us what we cannot do for myself. And through a series of events with working on this conference, I was brought to a wonderful group of women that today I can say love me in spite of myself. Because I am my worst enemy. Everyone will and must fail you at some point. And I was brought to my knees. And I started getting into that 11th step, the prayer and meditation. If I'm going to have a relationship with you, I just can't be sitting there and talk to you. I have to sit back and I have to listen and be able to receive the things that you're giving to me. And so I started listening, being still within myself, did quite a few fourth and fifth steps, and realized that I was still angry. And I had become extremely reactive to everyone and everything around me. I know today, no matter what life throws at me, whether it be marriage, divorce, deaths in the family, good things coming to me, I have a faith that works under any condition. And the guy who was in the skit when he was talking about God, he talks in the big book how the main purpose of this book is to help you find a God of your understanding, which will help you recover from that hopeless, seemingly state of body and mind. And today I can say that I have that. That hole is filled. You know, I've gone through a lot of changes this year, and I was talking with a friend of mine, and I said, you know, I never thought that I would be here at almost 10 years sober. But if I stopped and I really thought about it, once again, it was as outside trapping things, but if I looked at my life, I have a host of friends that are so incredible, that love and support me and help me and guide me through anything. I have some of the best damn sponsorship in the state of Georgia, and I have no problem saying that from behind this podium. I'm a part of instead of apart from. My God, my strength. It's an incredible and amazing thing. And I didn't realize how free I could be. I did not realize. And I always get the question from my sponsorees. They always go, well, what's God's will? What's God's will? And I like to keep things really simple. And for me, how I figured out what God's will is for me, if I live the these steps. I don't talk about working them. If I live these steps on a daily basis, if I practice these principles in all my affairs, if I'm mean to you, I promptly admitted it. Today, for me, those decisions based on self, those decisions based on self, am I willing to suffer those consequences? Am I willing to not only hurt me, but other people around me? Because when I make those decisions based on self, I usually end up hurting a few of you out there. Is it worth it? God, because of the God of my understanding, I am aware today. And I, you know, they used to say the definition of insanity is repeating the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. For me, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and knowing exactly what's going to happen. Because I know exactly what's going to happen. I've been around too damn long to know, not to know that, you know, because if I'm not just working, but if I'm living these steps and I'm practicing these principles in my life, I'm doing God's will. God wants me to be honest. He wants me to be loving. He wants me to be of service to you. He wants me to be conscious of Him. You know, and what's really interesting is I like to look at different religions and things. And if you notice, if you're not a religious person, but if you notice, these principles are the same. Love, honesty, compassion, helping others. And so you can take a little bit here, and you can take a little bit there, and leave what you don't want. But I know for me that whatever comes up in my life, I can get through it. As long as I keep that conscious contact, as long as I remain open. It takes more energy for me today to remain closed and to keep you at arm's length and not to let you know who I am. And it takes less energy for me to be open. Yeah, I may get hurt, but I won't be able to experience those extreme joy, and I wouldn't be able to experience the happiness and the love and the compassion and the understanding that you're willing to give me. It's a wonderful thing. I did it this way, and I tried this way. You know, it basically what it says in the big book, you can die, or you can have a spiritual life. Death, spirituality. Death, spirituality. And I weighed those two out for the longest time. You know, I tried every single way I could except for the spiritual way. I really did. I would sit there and I go, okay, I'm going to give my finances over to God. Okay, I think I'll give my love life over to the care of God. Okay, I think, you know, I'm picking and choosing. But when I completely turned over my will to God, that's when all these incredible, amazing things started to happen for me. You know, I may not have the fancy car today, and I may not have the big house, and I may not have this, and I may not have that, but I have myself, and I have my God, and that's all I need. I'm whole today. I'm whole. And I'm so glad to be here. I really am, that I'm able to share this with you. And I will end that on that note. Thank you.